Gentlemen, welcome once again to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak. I want to welcome you here to our little interview session. We've got Mr. Joe Mollet of Preserve Our Paradise. Welcome, Mr. Mollet.
Good morning, listeners. Good morning, Rick. How are you this morning?
Very good, sir. Very good. You know, for a long time now, for probably the last 2 years, I've heard people say, don't worry about Florida. No, you don't need to worry about Florida. There's no fracking going to happen down here. We're perfectly safe. That's a problem for Pennsylvania. Joe?
Yes.
Not so, is it?
No, and we do have to worry about it. The biggest problem that we have is they're disguising the type of drilling that they're doing. It is what's called horizontal drilling. You'll hear the folks from Collier Resources and Collier Enterprises, who jointly manage about 800,000 acres of mineral rights out here, that they are not fracking. Well, technically, they are not fracking. That is correct. But they are going down vertically, then out horizontally for miles, and they're using the same toxic chemical cocktails that are being used in fracking. The only difference is that so far they're not fracking but doing the same type of drilling. They're taking this water, they're using our water actually regardless of whether there is a drought or no drought. They have no limitations. They can tap 4 million gallons or more a month to do the drilling process and then mix it in with all these toxic chemicals in order to be able to get to the oil. They're taking this then and they're putting it right back underground where it can possibly bleach into our aquifer and tarnish the water that supplies a good part of South Florida. It's horrific.
You know, there's so much to delve into, and I'm going to just try to do this gently, step at a time. How did you first hear that fracking, call it what you want to call it, deep injection, horizontal drilling, pouring toxic poisons down there so they can get out some gas? When did you first hear about it happening in our backyard?
Well, I'll tell you what, for me, it was sort of an accident approximately 2.5 months ago. Someone that I'd met a couple years ago came knocking on my door while I was working outside with the wife and said, are you aware of the fact that they're going to be fracking in our area here? And I said, no, I did not. This had all been relatively quiet. They thought that they could really do the drilling and not notify the neighbors, except that by law, they had to notify the folks within 1 mile of the area. It's under 1 mile. It's 1,000 feet of the area where they're actually going to be doing the drilling. And these folks woke up one afternoon in April to find a notice on their doors and on their mailboxes from a company called Total Safety. And this asked them for their personal information in case of an emergency, in case of toxic gas, in case of an explosion, that who could they notify to say evacuate? Well, that's a bit ludicrous. They want the information. It would be a little bit too late. By the time that something happens out there, it's a cinder block. So that's basically when I found out, and I got involved with quite a few people who were concerned about this, and we formed the group Preserve Our Paradise to try to fight the drilling going on in Collier and in other parts of Florida.
Okay, let's go over some of the other terrain issues. Now, obviously, Florida aquifers are made of very permeable material. How do they suggest that this is going to be isolated? Is it just depth they're looking at?
It's a combination of things. They're looking at depth for their injection wells to take the water that they've used up and filled with these chemicals to put it back underground. They're contesting that they're putting it away from where our drinking water would be. They're saying that they have special concrete and metal casings on the pipes once they're done with it to seal them. But the truth of the matter is that actually last weekend, USA Today ran an article showing that some of these materials do break, do crack, and do leak, causing contamination. So there is nothing secure, and we know that when you take any sort of metal or composite and you put it underground over time, this will deteriorate, and it would cause that toxic substance to get into our water. Now, they come up with all kinds of different suggestions, saying, no, it's a brine, it's got salt in it, and it's going to be heavier, it's not going to get into the aquifer. But no matter how you look at it, these folks aren't taking the right safety measures. There is a tremendous chance that it's going to happen. It's happened in other parts of the country, and it can happen here as well.
But, Mr. Mulley, their name is Total Safety. Aren't you reassured?
I'll tell you, it's interesting that they're anything but total safety. We dug up, an article from 2 years ago where it was someplace out in the in the western United States, and I don't have exactly where it was. I can get you a copy of the article. But they were supposed to perform an inspection at a site where they were doing drilling, and they did not perform the right inspection. There was some gas that was released. Two people were killed as the result of an explosion. One of the two bodies was never found, and a third one was maimed to where he lost three limbs and filed suit against Total Safety and Schlumberger, I believe it was at the time. So these folks are anything but total safety.
Okay. Now, I understand, although the reports that we had from plenty of environmentalists, that the only possible repository was up in the panhandle, I understand that they're talking about a structure that goes all the way from Naples across to Miami, right across the Everglades National Park. Is that what you're hearing?
When you're saying a structure, you're referring to the aquifer? Or?
Correct.
Yes. The aquifer that we have that covers southwest Florida here also extends all the way down to Miami-Dade County. So it is not just the folks in Collier and Lee that are at risk, but folks in other parts of South Florida are at risk as well. Once they start drilling in different parts of the area here, that risk of contamination increases. We have local government that is considering looking at our airports here and possibly leasing out parts of the land for drilling additionally out here as a source of income. It doesn't amount to much, and what we'd also found is there's a state law that was kind of snuck in by state senators giving these folks significant tax breaks on the drilling as well. So there's even more of an incentive for them to be able to drill and paying less taxes ultimately on the product that they bring out of the ground.
Isn't that just extraordinarily generous of the taxpayers to help underwrite their costs?
I think it is ridiculous. I think that the local governments that we have, I think that the state government is not doing its part. Everybody from the Department of Environmental Protection, we just saw in an article that came out of the Tampa Tribune that actually said that these folks, right after the deadline, June 30th, where we had to have comments back to the Department of Environmental Protection, saying the reasons why the permit for Hughes drilling should not be approved, that these folks are being given bonuses within the Department of Environmental Protection for a speedy and expeditious approval of these permits. That's ridiculous.
Okay, let me stop you right there for just a second.
I'm sorry.
Let me stop you right there for a second because that is so significant, and I'm afraid a lot of people didn't hear you. Please say that again. Our environmental regulators are being incentivized exactly to do what, sir?
To speed up the process of approving permits. Yes,
so
it's exactly
let's not
what I
have
said.
Too much regulation. Let's not have any close examination. And if they just let this stuff go on, let this stuff go through, they get a bonus. Doesn't sound much like what you'd want to have happen for regulators, does it?
No, it doesn't. And also when we consider the fact that these folks are in existence, their department and their positions really only exist to approve these permits. So if you think about it, if they don't approve the permits, if this industry doesn't thrive, they don't have a job. This is their responsibility and their function. It's kind of ludicrous if you really think about it.
Unfortunately, it is, but that's the way too much of our Florida non-regulatory environment works. I understand you have an event going on tomorrow on Independence Day.
That is correct. We are going to be heading towards the downtown area of Naples, and we are going to be handing flyers out to folks that are making their way down to the beach to watch the fireworks. I think that we have potentially fireworks of our own in the Golden Gate Estates area if these folks aren't careful with their drilling. But we want to continue to promote awareness. We had a vigil at the Naples Pier a couple of nights ago, and we constantly are wanting to let people know, because everywhere I go, everyone I speak to, I let them know about what's going on, and I am shocked that one out of every maybe 10 people is aware of what's going on. And a lot of people are of the attitude that it's not in my backyard. Well, it is, because even if you're on a municipal water source, the contaminants that these people are looking to inject down through their injection well are things that could get through the municipal water system, things that will be able to contaminate your water no matter what. They're living in a world where it's not the reality, unfortunately, for them. But
we are trying
to educate everyone as much as we can.
Are we also facing a situation where they don't have to tell you what poisons they're putting in the ground?
That is correct. Legislation is afoot to try to give these folks more leeway in terms of what they put in without having to have disclosure. I guess it's almost like going back to the days when you can go to the grocery store and whatever you buy, imagine now that wouldn't have any labels on it telling you what ingredients are on there that you're going to be exposed to. It's that same kind of mindset. We're going to put stuff into your ground where your aquifer is, but we're not going to tell you what it is. That's a total shock to me. It's just government doing the least that it possibly can solely to really follow an energy-independent policy so that we can avoid our dependence on foreign oil. Well, we can do that if we look at renewable resources that we have, if we look at wind, if we look at solar, and other means that we have of getting power and cutting back on those utilities that require and those enterprises that require oil. Let's do something different. Let's not destroy what we have here.
Sir, let me ask you another question. Are you finding any support in whether it be municipal or county level officials?
We're finding at best a degree of neutrality within county officials. They're of the mindset that, you know, there's only so much that we can do. And in some cases, they say that there's nothing that they can do, that it is all at the state and federal level. So the local folks are kind of hiding behind the skirt of the state and the state behind the federal and so on, so that nobody really likes to assume responsibility. The commissioners in Collier County did write a letter to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, but it was very weak, basically just saying, please look at all the comments that have been submitted to you before you make your decision. Well, that's not really saying a whole lot. They didn't try to influence them in any way. They didn't say, you have a lot of threats that you haven't looked at. There's things that haven't really been considered. I was surprised that we had a meeting that was set up by the Civic Association, and really it was Commissioner Nance was there, but he was not the one sponsoring that event. And we had the folks from Collier and Hughes once again. These folks got out there and they spoke, and basically their mindset is, you know what, we can do this. It's our mineral rights, and we could take whatever we want, and ultimately we're going to do it, regardless of what impact it can have on the local community and the extended community when you look, as we said earlier, as to how far this aquifer extends. They're putting a lot of people at risk unnecessarily. In some cases, to even hydrogen sulfide gas, where they're saying, and this was one of the things that was mentioned in their contingency plan, Hughes's contingency plan, that hydrogen sulfide gas could be released. When you read what they have in that contingency plan, in several instances they say, do not panic, in bold letters. Now, what they're also saying is that their workers should be on the buddy system in case one is overtaken by these gases. Let me say, Rick, that hydrogen sulfide is as bad, if not worse, than the cyanide gas that was used in trench warfare in World War I. It is a horrible way to kill a person or an animal. You'll smell it for a few seconds, then you'll no longer smell that rotten odor of eggs that are rotting, and then the next thing you know, your olfactory senses are gone, and then you are as well, too. It's an agonizing and painful death that comes as a result of this. Part of what they're looking to subject the neighboring community out here to, besides the contamination that's possible through their injection of the toxic waters near our aquifer.
Well, I understand that the deep injection wells that had been proposed by the Bush administration in Florida were ultimately found to be unsafe, and they were stopped. It seems odd that these things would be resurrected at such a convenient time to ostensibly protect us from these additional poisons that are going to be pumped into the ground. You know, when you look at the fact that the Everglades have been rendered into such a desperate condition, the flow from the north cut off, only little small amounts of water are being reflown, released southward, most of the water from the Lake Okeechobee is being released laterally. It seems like a terrible thing to put the Everglades at further risk with this kind of thing. Now, one of the answers I've also heard them say is that, well, they've been drilling in Collier County for a long time, but they haven't been fracking in Collier County. Isn't that true?
That is correct. And that's what they try to hide behind, the fact that they've been drilling for so long. But if we look at how much oil they've drilled in the 70 years, it's less than one day's worth of world production today. So that's as much as they've had cumulatively. And again, the vast majority of it was vertical drilling, put your pipe down, get to the oil, bring it up, not using the methods that they're using today. So they're kind of saying, well, it's been right all along, but it's not, because it's not the same type of drilling. You cannot confuse one with the other, and they're trying to pull the wool over the public's eyes and trying to make them think that it's okay and it's safe. Well, it's not.
How about, and I hesitate to ask because I can probably guess the answer, has any state representatives or state senators, either on the state or the federal level, raised any interest?
Well, we've been in contact with several different state and federal agencies. We've been talking to the office of Lincoln Diaz-Balart. We've been talking to the office of Bill Nelson. I personally have spoken with Lauren Scher of the legislative assistant for Bill Nelson in Washington. I've sent her information via email, and she's looking at a lot of the concerns that we have. I indicated initially when I spoke to her almost 2 weeks ago that we had a concern that June 30th, the deadline would arrive and go, and that we would not have another period of time for comments for the DEP to seriously look at this. So we're still waiting on answers from the different elected representatives. We haven't really gotten anything substantive at all back yet, but I'm sure that they're trying, and hopefully they will be able to do something to protect the health, welfare, and well-being of the citizens that put them in office, quite frankly.
Does the Soil and Water Conservation Board for Collier or South Florida Water Management have a say in any of these regulatory matters?
South Florida Water Management does, and they actually had cut back how much Hughes could draw in terms of water. I believe that they were looking for somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 million gallons a month, and they were cut back to 4 million gallons a drawdown. But they're going to be actually starting this drilling. If they approve the permit, everything's going to be starting in about the October time frame. If that is the case, we're getting into the driest season for us here. So it's at a time when you're going to be pulling out a lot of water, when the aquifer, the waters are going to be low, the rains are going to be long gone by that point. We may be in a drought situation where signs will be posted, as they were for the last 3 years that I've lived out here, saying you have to cut back on water use because of the low water levels. But they won't have to. They have their okay from water management already to proceed. And we're still trying to work with these folks with regards to the injection wells and trying to make sure that they counter them. we can't have them take these toxins and put them back in. It's just unconscionable to think that they could do it and feel that it would be safe no matter what, that at, in perpetuity, this thing will be separate from the rest of the aquifer. It's insane to think that that could stay in that manner.
I was once told by a nuclear plant worker at Turkey Point that, well, yeah, we leave these expended fuel rods in shallow coral rock channels, but it's okay because coral rock isn't permeable.
I have to laugh when I hear something like that.
You know, you have to. These people are not touched by science, or they're touched by corporate science, which means we get the answers that we want. Joe, for people who are concerned, how can they get in touch with the organization? How can they get in touch with you? How can they get involved in trying to stop or mitigate the damage that's clearly about to occur?
Right. Well, we ask folks, we ask your listeners to visit both our page on the web. It is preserveourparadise.org, and we also have Preserve Our Paradise on Facebook. Go to the web, and you'll see the links to all the different news articles that we've been involved in with TV stations, video clips where we've given interviews, and a lot of information that we have to help educate the public. If they want to reach out to us, go through, and it shows that on the webpage, contact@preserveourparadise.org. And typically those emails are channeled to me or someone else on staff, and I make sure that we answer each one as expeditiously as possible when they come in. And we will get the information to folks, and if they want to volunteer, I'd like to hear from them and send us the email address and a contact number, and I personally will call them and let them know how they can help to stop this from spreading.
Well, Joe, we really appreciate you coming on. If you were to sum up both how you see the situation right now and your plan of attack for the next few months, obviously organizing an outdoor event in summertime in Florida is very hard to do. Do you have something planned for August, September, or what's your medium to long range plan?
Well, we have several, and our plans are the following. We will continue to create events that will touch the public in different places, but we are also looking at forming strategic alliances with a lot of different groups that are working towards the same goal. We've been in contact with different folks out here, the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, Florida Wildlands Association, Food and Water Watch, a lot of different folks, and we need to really come to the table together so that we all work jointly. We at Preserve Our Paradise are just in the process of setting up a not-for-profit corporation so that we can hopefully operate more effectively and being able to file, if necessary, legal action to try to stop this. And at that point, we'll be able to, if anyone would like to make a donation and we're set up within the next month or so, we would take that and it would go towards the cause of legal representation. So there's a lot that we have on our agenda, both publicly, different events, and like you said, in summer they're difficult, Rick, but we're still there, rain or shine. And the other one is working with other groups, looking at the laws, and trying to fight these people wherever we possibly can.
You know, it might be time for a Florida Environmental Summit. There's an awful lot of organizations, you know, and everybody's out there doing good work, and that's all laudable, and I know we have our own time limitations, and Florida is such a long state, but it really might be time to pull together some kind of environmental summit so that we can get everybody at the table, so that these literally critical life and death, destroying the Everglades kind of things can be stopped by a real solid phalanx of opponents. We need to stand up. We don't have the money, but we have the people and we have the science behind us. We've got to get something organized. Thank you so much, Joe. We really appreciate it. And
thank
if there's anything else we can do, keep us informed. Let us know when you have events. We'll be glad to help publicize it, okay?
We will do that. Thank you, Rick, and thank you, listeners. Have a great day.
You too, sir. Thank you so much. That was Joe Mole of Preserve Our Paradise. Okay, we're going to go to a little bit of music, and then we will continue with some news. Here's an old favorite. Just in, U.S. Director of National Intelligence has apologized for denying in March that the NSA collected data on millions of Americans, but one senator remains deeply troubled. U.S. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper has attempted to head off criticism that he lied to Congress over the extent of government surveillance on American citizens, with a letter to senators in which he apologized for giving, quote, erroneous, quote, information. 2 weeks after telling NBC News that he gave the least untruthful answer possible. Let me try that again. Least untruthful answer possible. At a hearing in March, Clapper wrote to the Senate Intelligence Committee to correct his response to a question about whether the United States National Security Agency collected data on millions of Americans. But the senator who asked the question, Ron Wyden, said on Monday that Clapper's office had admitted in private that his answer was wrong after the March hearing. Yet the intelligence chief only corrected the record on 21 June when disclosures by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden prompted weeks of intense public pressure. Senator Wyden is deeply troubled by a number of misleading statements. We used to call those lies. Senior officials have made about domestic surveillance in the past several years. He will continue pushing for an open and honest debate about programs and laws that touch on the personal lives of ordinary Americans. In the March hearing, Wyden grew frustrated that he could not get a direct answer, you know, straight answer, from Mr. Clapper. A question that said the senator had been posing the intelligence agencies in a series of letters for a year. When do U.S. spies need a warrant to surveil American communications? What I wanted to see is if you could give me a yes or no answer to the question. Does NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? Wyden asked Clapper. He responded, no, sir, not wittingly. That's the least untruthful answer. No, sir, not wittingly. And when there are cases that could be inadvertently, perhaps collect, but not wittingly. So they're doing this witlessly, not wittingly. So without wit, they are collecting this information. That's good. I am so reassured. After Snowden's disclosure in The Guardian through a spotlight on Clapper's statement, he gave an interview to Andrea Mitchell of MSNBC, portions of which were first broadcast in June 9. In the interview, Clapper explained the apparent inconsistency with the facts as a ploy to avoid revealing classified information. On 18 June, Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, accused Clapper directly of lying, pointing out that lying on oath, or under oath, as we used to say, to Congress was a crime and questioned whether he could continue in his position. According to the last revelation in the Washington Post on Monday, and confirmed by an Obama administration official, Clapper wrote to the Senate Intelligence Committee on 21 June, when he admitted directly that his answer was wrong, my response was clearly erroneous. The witless answer. For which I apologize, said Clapper. Clapper now appears to row back from his MSNBC position that his March answer was calculated to avoid betraying confidential information. In the letter, Clapper said he had misunderstood the question. But Clapper didn't say why it had taken him until June to correct the mistake. Senator Wyden's spokesman made it clear on Monday that the senator had made an attempt to get Clapper to correct the record before revelations in The Guardian, but was rebuffed. Senator Wyden had a staff member contact the Office of Director of National Intelligence on a secure phone line soon after the March hearing to address the inaccurate statement regarding the bulk collection of American information. The ODNI, or ODNI, acknowledged that the statement was inaccurate, but refused to correct the public record when given the opportunity. Senator Wyden's staff informed the ODNI that this was a serious concern. Senator Wyden continued to raise questions about the government's reliance on secret hidden law in the weeks following the hearing, prior to The Guardian publishing its first story several weeks later. A spokesman for the Office of the DNI said on Monday, Director Clapper has deep respect for the role of oversight committees in both keeping our nation safe and ensuring the privacy of all Americans are protected, witlessly or not. The Intelligence Committee will continue to work all members of Congress to ensure the proper balance of privacy and protection for American citizens, witless or not. In his MSNBC interview, Clapper said he believed Wyden's question was unfair, akin to asking him when he was going to stop beating his wife. The question was, what? When is it required to have a warrant? That doesn't sound to me like a when are you just not beating your wife question. Wyden led a bipartisan group of 26 senators who wrote to Clapper last week to complain the administration is relying on a secret body of law to collect massive amounts of data on U.S. citizens. The senator, including four Republicans, also accused the intelligence chiefs of making a number of misleading statements which prevented proper public debate on the subject. We're concerned that by depending on secret interpretations of the Secret Patriot Act that differed from an intuitive reading of the statute, his program essentially relied on for years on a secret body of law, they said. Then, of course, there's the secret courts. This and misleading statements by intelligence officials have prevented our constituents from evaluating the decisions that their government was making and, unfortunately, will undermine the trust in government more broadly. And speaking of the public trust, this is Senator Warren on the capture of federal courts.
Washington, power is not balanced. Indeed, power is becoming more concentrated on one side. There are powerful, deep-pocketed corporate interests lined up to fight to protect their privilege and to resist any change that would limit corporate excesses. Powerful corporate interests understand that if they can rig the courts, a friendly judicial system will give them a second bite at whatever they want. So I came here today because I had a message I wanted to bring personally. And here it is. There is an intense fight going on right now over what our federal courts will look like. It is a fight over whether those courts will remain a neutral forum faithfully interpreting the law and dispensing impartial justice, or whether we will see corporate capture of the federal courts, with the courts transformed into one more version of the rigged game. And right now, we're losing that fight. The reasons are many. Consider the composition of the federal bench. Look at the federal bench, and you'll see a striking lack of professional diversity among the lawyers who serve as federal judges. According to a study published by ACS earlier this year, as of 2008, the federal bench was dominated, this is a quote, dominated by judges whose previous professional experience is generally corporate or prosecutorial. Now, I want to be clear. There are some really, really talented judges who come from the private sector. I myself have worked for private clients. And it is, of course, true that the personal views of an attorney often diverge from those of his or her clients. But I think diversity of experience really matters. At his induction ceremony, Judge Chen was quoted as saying he never considered withdrawing his name from consideration. But here was his reason. He said, "I believe that someone should not be disqualified from the bench simply because they once represented the voiceless and the unpopular rather than the wealthy and the powerful." And I believe Judge Chen is right. That's right. Or take a look at the win rate of the Chamber of Commerce. According to the Constitutional Accountability Center, the Chamber moved from a 43% win rate during the very conservative Berger Court to a 56% win rate under the very conservative Rehnquist Court, and now they are at a 70% win rate under the Roberts Court. Follow this pro-business trend to its logical conclusion. Sooner or later, you will end up with a Supreme Court that functions as a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chamber of Commerce. So, what do we do? Well, I don't kid myself. Fighting back is not easy. Powerful interests invested in the status quo, they know what's at stake. They are organized. They are effective, and they come to this battle armed with lobbyists and lawyers. We are up against a conservative movement that for 30 years, since President Reagan, has dedicated itself to packing the courts with pro-business, anti-regulation, conservative allies. They are tough, and they are prepared. We will not win all of the fights ahead, but if we are going to have a chance, we begin by speaking out about what is happening in our courts. We have to do that. It is time for a new generation of judges, judges whose life experiences extend beyond big firms, federal prosecution, and white-collar defense. We need sustained pressure on those judges to get them in front of the United States Senate. We need pressure on our president, pressure on our senators, pressure on the press. And if the judges don't get a vote, if they are blocked, if they can't get through, then we need to change the filibuster rules to get them through. So we got a lot of different folks in here who have a lot of different interests, but I want to make this as clear as I can. If you care about the Affordable Care Act, if you care about the Voting Rights Act, if you care about financial reform, then your fight is not just a fight about policy. Your fight is not just a fight in Congress. Your fight is in the courts. Your fate is tied to judges who will decide these cases, and your fight must be to bring a new generation of judges to the bench. That's what we have to do.
Now, that was Elizabeth Warren talking about the threat in the courts. Got another story I want to share with you before we get our next guest on there. This is a story about the drones. We've all heard that the drones are accurate and they mostly kill the bad guys. And of course, the drones that will come over our skies will certainly only be spies. They won't be, no, don't worry, they won't be armed or anything. No, no, no. So here's a story that I want to share. This is goes like this. Despite claims by the Obama administration that drone attacks are precise and surgical, a new study released this week shows that drone strikes cause 10 times more civilian casualties than what we already knew occurs in conventional warfare in the ongoing U.S. war in Afghanistan. Pulling from military data collected between 2010 and mid-2011 in Afghanistan, the height of U.S. drone attacks, Larry Lewis, principal research scientist at the Center for Naval Analyses and advisor to the military's joint staff, found that the rate of civilian casualties from drone strikes is far more drastic than what the administration had alluded to. This must be another one of those witless responses. As Spencer Ackerman at The Guardian reports, the findings appear to undermine the claim made by President Obama in a May speech that conventional air power or missiles are far less precise than drones and likely to cause more civilian casualties and local outrage. Well, it seems there's local outrage aplenty. On the contrary, the study finds that drone strikes in Afghanistan were an order of magnitude more likely. That's more likely to result in civilian casualties per engagement, a fact that directly refutes the Obama justification for the rampant use of unmanned drones. There's been a great fuss made about it being difficult for Tea Partiers to get a tax break. This is another story that you probably want to know about. While on the one hand, there's been a great fuss made about how difficult it is for Tea Party to get a tax break for their donations. Oh my God, they use the word Tea Party when the IRS was sorting through those stacks of applications. Of course, they also did search for Progressive as well, which makes sense since it's tax deductible, supposed to be for charity, not politics. Sensible thing to look for. But it seems it's odd, though, to me, that there's been no comparable fuss over the filing cabinets in the Bahamas where the corporate assets go in single drawers to hide from their tax responsibilities. Why no citizen outrage on that tax matter? It seems kind of odd to me. Okay, now a little bit of music before we go on to our next story, and then we'll have in just a few minutes an interview with Susan Booker, who is the supervisor of elections for Palm Beach County. I also want to mention that this weekend's coming show is our voting rights show, where my associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker, will join me as we interview the charming and talented Mr. Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push, Progressive Push Trains candidates. Susan Booker will be appearing there. Also, we have a special report from Samantha Hope Herring of the Democratic Women's Club of Bay County about stolen votes, something you definitely want to catch. And then Pam Goodwin of the League of Women Voters will also be addressing redistricting. So it's a voting discussion day. And then we've got a candidate for office from the Vero Beach area, Miss Corey Westbrook, will also be joining us for our Roading Rights show. Hope you tune in. And that's Sunday the 7th of July. And now a little bit of music. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got our next guest here, so I'm going to go ahead and fade out the music and bring on our favorite supervisor of elections. Welcome, Ms. Booker.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Very good. And yourself?
I'm very good. Thank you.
You know, Ms. Booker, it is such an honor to have you here. You are the person that protects the integrity of the votes in Palm Beach County. You have such responsibility in your hands. It is such important work for democracy. I can't thank you enough and appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us.
Well, I really appreciate the work that you're doing as well. It helps a lot to inform our voters of what's going on, not only, you know, in our county and statewide, but nationally. There's been a tremendous impact with the recent ruling on the Supreme Court about the Voter Rights Act. And I'm hoping that that's what we can talk about today.
I wish you would. Go ahead, Ms. Booker.
Well, you know, just about a week and a half ago, the Supreme Court provided a decision, and it struck down the 1965 Voter Rights Act that's been in place and has been renewed in a bipartisan manner, most recently in 2006. And during that vote, it was a bipartisan vote. In the House, it was 390-3, and in the Senate, it was 98-0 to extend the Voting Rights Act with a Republican-controlled legislators in 2006. They believed that discrimination still existed, and this law covered certain territories that were proven to have discrimination for voters in the past. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court decided that there's a Section 4, and it provided the impetus for people to challenge unusual voting laws that would go in place to try and disenfranchise some of our voters. And that was some provisions that provided protection up front before this would occur. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court decided that the data, the information that was used to reauthorize that act, is outdated. But they did acknowledge that discrimination still exists. In fact, John Roberts, Supreme Court Justice, he's the Chief Justice, said that he believed that discrimination in voting is a real threat and continues to exist. What he decided is that discrimination today looks markedly different from what it did decades ago, so he indicated that the law had to be updated by Congress. And so, unfortunately, we've heard very little from Congress about restarting that process. You know, what I think he really meant to say is that, you know, in the past there were blatant attempts to stop people from voting, police activity at the polls, lots of different things, you know, turning people away unusually. And I think what they're talking about is today what we're seeing is these laws, these very thinly veiled laws, for instance, they passed in 2011 in the state of Florida, to decrease the voter turnout. And so I think we'll find ample information if Congress takes this up real quickly to take a look at the decision that the Supreme Court provided and work on providing some updated data. I think part of the data comes from the state of Florida, decreasing early voting to in half, providing only constrained facilities for early voting, making people vote by provisional ballots. You know, there's a lot of activity that happened in 2011, but I'm pleased to say that, you know, through public pressure and through media like yourself and others, the legislature substantially amended those 2011 laws this year in 2013, and it will bring back the full 14 days of early voting at the discretion of the supervisor, and also at the discretion of supervisors, is to reinstate the final Sunday voting that's traditionally known as souls to the polls, which impacts a lot of African American communities.
Well, I'd like to hope that we won't see the voter purges and those kind of adventures that we've seen too often, and not just here. And we still have these onerous voter ID laws. But that being said, I'll be happy to take your slightly more positive take on the Supreme Court than maybe some of us have.
Well, we have. There is another provision by which these laws, you know, within hours, there were numerous states that said, you know, yippee, the preclearance or the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice is gone, and they swiftly intended to change laws that had been stopped by the federal courts and the Department of Justice. So we're really hoping that Congress will hurry up and pick this action up as quickly as possible. And I'll tell you, here in the state of Florida, there were attempts to purge voters. You know, fortunately, I know the law exceedingly well, and the determination is that of the supervisor of elections. And I was the supervisor to say, no, your data is almost 12 years old. We're not going to purge our voters. You need to prove beyond a credible doubt that these are voters that we should take off our rolls. The state was unable to do that, and the purge was discontinued.
Well, you know, that is a remarkable thing. You and several other supervisors of elections stood up to this clearly bogus attempt to constrain voting again. And you also were telling me that you have some other good news in terms of being able to get equipment out in the field.
Well, we do. You know, this is the first time I've had any time off without elections in the 4 years that I've been the supervisor. And what we're working on is some new technology. Some very simple off-the-shelf technology will allow us to move voters through in a faster pace. We actually are working on some mini iPads right off the shelf. And those iPads can take a picture of the QR code, the little squiggly code on the backside of your driver's license. It'll populate your voter information. You'll sign that mini iPad. It'll send a message to our database to say that you're voting, and it will print you a ballot so that we can move you through quicker. We also lobbied the legislature and were successful in getting to go to larger locations for early voting. Right now, the law, before they changed it, and what was in effect in 2012, only allowed us to go to libraries and city halls and our offices for early voting facilities. Well, what we found is these were all constrained facilities, and we couldn't put more than two ballot printers in there without blowing breakers. So now we can go to places like stadiums, convention centers, fairgrounds, community centers, senior centers. And what we're working on now is to provide additional ballot printers, and along with the iPads and a lot more staff, what the goal here in Palm Beach County is to eliminate the lines. Since early voting began in 2004, we've always had long lines at early voting. And this last year we had 14 facilities, and they just didn't prove to be enough because the legislature had cut those days in half to 8 days. Now what we have is more hours than we've ever had before. We had 96 hours available to us last year, and in the future going forward, we will have 168 hours that Palm Beach will utilize to the fullest extent. We'll be able to go to places like our downtown convention center and the fairgrounds. We'll put five or six printers out there, lots of people, iPads, and I think that we will be able to eliminate our lines.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's nice to hear some good news for a change.
We're working on it.
Let me ask you a slightly more difficult question, and if you don't have the material at your hand, I understand. You can probably just talk in broad brush terms. What kind of percentages have we seen in the voting participation last few years?
During gubernatorial elections, we usually don't peak above 50% here in Palm Beach County, which is very unfortunate. But during the presidential elections, we usually come to a level of just under 70% of the voters who are eligible come out and vote. So last year, during the general election, we had 870,182 eligible voters, and actually 605,268 total votes were counted, and that is a percentage of 69.56%. For the gubernatorial elections, if you look back traditionally, it's 47-49% turnout. So I think that the people really don't understand the importance of their state leadership and that their legislative races are on there, and they have the ability to really impact the way that laws are established in the state of Florida by going out and voting in the gubernatorial election as well.
Well, certainly those people who've noticed Mr. Scott's governance style, hopefully they will be coming out and expressing their opinions on this Florida governor.
Well, I also want the people to know that not all of the laws that were passed this year were positive. You know, absentee ballots have become a tremendous importance in every election. They usually account for over a fourth of all of the voters who voted. So in the general election, we saw over 157,000 absentee ballots cast in Palm Beach County. And, you know, the legislature changed the law to say that if you want an absentee ballot mailed to any address other than voter registration address where you're registered at, you have to submit a new request in writing with your signature. Now, we think, the supervisors think, that it's going to tremendously impact the snowbirds and also the students. And there's nobody out there telling them that information. And I think that it is designed to target those voters to decrease the number of absentee voters that we will receive in the next 2014 election.
If you were counseling our listeners, should they have the same level of confidence with an absentee ballot that they would have with a personally cast ballot?
Well, if they followed the directions properly, I would say yes. And the reason why I say that is sometimes people forget to sign the outside of their envelope for their absentee ballot. Now, the supervisors successfully lobbied the legislature to say, hey, if the people don't sign it and it's before Election Day, we post it on our website. You can look at your status and it'll show you when your absentee ballot was returned to us. And if it says that you didn't sign it, we passed a law that will now allow us to receive an affidavit and a copy of a picture signature ID from a voter before Election Day. The deadline is the day before Election Day. We can put that with the absentee ballot envelope that's not signed, and we can now open the ballot and count it. In the past, if you didn't sign the outside envelope and we received your ballot, there was nothing you could do about it. We could not open that envelope and count your ballot. So I think absentee voters should be pretty confident. We are extremely careful in making sure that on a daily basis, all of the ballots that we're receiving are being accounted for, balanced, and counted. We start counting those ballots 15 days before each election. So the first election results that we always show on election night are actually absentee ballot votes and early votes that we already have. So we post those right at 7:30 during every election. So your ballot does count. You just have to carefully follow the directions.
I know there's occasionally you hear rumors that, well, they only count the absentee ballots if. And that's not really the case, is it?
No, it's not. Like I just said, we count the absentee ballots first. We keep receiving them throughout the election cycle. The law allows us to begin opening those ballots 15 days before the election, so then we're all ready to go. There's a new law that requires us to upload, to count all of those ballots and upload to our computer system all of the numbers. We just can't hit the totals until 7 p.m. when the polls close. And that's why we have such a quick turnaround on election night. Our first totals that we're showing on TV are from absentee ballots. So they're always counted first.
I see. Well, thank you so much. If our audience wants to double check their voting status, where can they go, either in person or online?
Well, certainly they can always call us at 561-656-6200, or they can go to our website, which is pbcelections.org, and on the right-hand side, there's something called Voter Information Lookup. You put your name and your date of birth in there, and it will tell you your voting status. It'll tell you where to go on election day, what your polling location address is. And if you're voting absentee ballot, it'll tell you if you have a request on file, and when we receive your ballot back in the mail that's already voted, it will tell you if it has been received appropriately or if there is no signature, or it'll tell you what the status of your absentee ballot is.
Well, thank you so much. I sure appreciate your time, and we appreciate what you do to guarantee the integrity of our vote. Too bad every county doesn't have someone as hardworking as you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work. I really appreciate your information to the public, and if I can be of any assistance to anybody out there, we work almost every day, and I'm very much interested in going and engaging with our public. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Booker.
Have Bye-bye. A great day.
You too. Okay, that was Ms. Susan Booker, Supervisor of Elections for Palm Beach County. I do want to play some other another interview that we got that is very informative. This is a whistleblower named Thomas Drake, and this was his appearance at the press club, and it's got some very important information, I think, to put the whistleblower concept in its proper frame. Here we go. This is Thomas Drake at the press club.
2 years ago, our guest today was accused by the U.S. Justice Department of espionage. The Air Force veteran and longtime senior executive at the National Security Agency was accused of giving classified documents to a news reporter. Thomas Drake faced 35 years in prison. A year later, on the eve of his trial, the government dropped all felony charges against Mr. Drake. He has since been honored as a whistleblower who helped to expose waste and fraud at the spy agency and to bring to light its massive effort to spy on Americans' own citizens. Mr. Drake's ordeal began coincidentally on September 11, 2001, which happened to be his first day as a full-time employee of the NSA. Like all other U.S. intelligence agencies, the NSA had missed key pieces of information that might have tipped off the government that the terrorist attacks were imminent. Shortly after 9/11, Mr. Drake came to believe that the agency could have predicted the attacks if it had made use of a surveillance system known as Thin Thread that could sift through massive amounts of data and detect patterns and key information. Instead, NSA leaders turned to outside contractor SAIC to build a new data collection system called Trailblazer that cost more than $1 billion, 10 times the cost of Thin Thread. At the same time, Mr. Drake learned that the agency was turning its surveillance capabilities on American citizens, which he believed was a violation of the U.S. Constitution. He decided to speak up. Mr. Drake reported his concerns about money wasted on Trailblazer and about domestic surveillance to Congress and to the Defense Department's Inspector General. He became a material witness in two 9/11 congressional investigations. Even after the Inspector General found that the Trailblazer project was a massive waste and the program was killed, little changed at the NSA. Mr. Drake then decided to go public. He brought his information about the problems with Trailblazer to a Baltimore Sun reporter who wrote a series of articles exposing the waste. Mr. Drake insists he did not reveal any classified information. Yet, when the New York Times in 2005 reported the stunning news that the U.S. government was tapping into its citizens' telephone calls with no warrants, Mr. Drake became a target in one of the most aggressive leak investigations in history. Agents raided his home in 2007, took his computers and files, and threatened that he could spend the rest of his life in prison. In 2010, the Justice Department indicted Mr. Drake for, quote, willful retention of classified documents. It was only the fourth time in history that a citizen was charged with espionage for mishandling documents. A conviction could have had a chilling effect on whistleblowers and on journalists who often receive and keep defense documents. Morton Halperin of the Open Society Institute said Mr. Drake's prosecution, quote, poses a grave threat to the mechanism by which we learn what the government does. Instead, the government's case fell apart when the government found no evidence that Mr. Drake willfully leaked classified information. Mr. Drake's sentencing judge said the prosecution was, quote, not proper. It does not pass the smell test. Thomas Drake now writes, speaks, and teaches about whistleblowing, constitutional rights, and abuse of government power. He's the recipient of the 2011 Ridenour Truth-Telling Prize and the 2011 Sam Adams Associates Integrity and Excellence Award. As we wrap up Sunshine Week here at the National Press Club, please help me give a warm welcome to Thomas Drake.
I'd like to thank the National Press Club for inviting me here. I'm looking forward to the Q&A, so I do have a few remarks to kind of set the tone and the tenor and to reflect quite in a sobering manner on what happened to me and what's at stake for this country. I've entitled my remarks, In the Shadowlands of the Secrecy State, Preying on the First Amendment. I first want to announce, however, that I can neither confirm nor deny that a solar eclipse cast by the shadow government is at least partially blocking the view of Sunshine Week. To do either might just reveal state secrets to reporters and journalists, including those of you in the room, unauthorized to receive them. And I would not want you all to end up with allegedly classified information regarding the weather in Washington, D.C. The White House blog on Wednesday said, quote, we celebrate Sunshine Week, an appropriate time to discuss the importance of open government and freedom of information, including a quote from President Obama saying, quote, openness will strengthen our democracy and promote efficiency and effectiveness in government. Really? Jocelyn Radak, the National Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project, remarked on Twitter just yesterday that after, quote, 3 years of shouting into the wilderness, unquote, she is relieved to see the Kool-Aid crowd is finally realizing that the Obama administration's draconian orgy of secrecy is finally reaching a boiling point. Glenn Greenwald with the Guardian newspaper published a very powerful article yesterday titled, quote, Obama's secrecy fixation causing Sunshine Week implosion. I'd like to remind everybody that President John F. Kennedy said that the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. I like to think that we have reached a critical event horizon. And whether national security as a new state religion will further suck the dwindling light of the First Amendment into the black hole of classification and secrecy hidden from public view. It seems that secrecy is actually strengthening the national security state in order to hide from accountability and oversight at the expense of informed public interest, where it matters the most. What is the price of keeping the public in the dark and having a government increasingly operating in the dark through secret law or interpretations in secret of existing law? After all, this very event is part of Sunshine Week, and I would like to highlight just one event that brings the message of Sunshine Week home regarding what's so at stake and our increasingly two-faced government. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee held hearings this week on addressing transparency in the federal bureaucracy, moving toward a more open government. The larger theme of the testimony before that committee centered on the inherent tension between the president's pledge for a new era of unprecedented openness and a record of invoking threats to national security to keep the public in the dark time and time again. The written testimony, and here I give a shout out to the Project on Government Oversight and their POGO blog, states, quote, there seems to be two Obama administrations, two American governments, really. One looks like a democracy in which an open government accountable to the people is an ideal and a priority. And the other is a national security state where claims of national security often trump democratic principles such as a people's right to know, civil liberties, freedom of speech, and whistleblower protections. Of course, this is not an approach exclusive to this president, but the unchecked secrecy of Obama's national security state is at cross purposes with many of his administration's openness objectives, and it raises doubts about the president's commitments and declarations about transparency, unquote. So given where we are today at the National Press Club, it seems to me that it's more than appropriate for us to discuss the long shadow of government secrecy obscuring the view of democracy in our constitutional republic, or what's left of it. Threats to the First Amendment by the government is bullseye centered on a free and unfettered press designed to suppress and repress speech and political expression in America, create fear through unilateral authority and privilege over what is fit or unfit for the First Amendment. If speech becomes the instrument of crime when revealing government crime and wrongdoing, we are under arbitrary authoritarian rule and not the rule of law. In our post-9/11 world, the government is increasingly in the First Un-Amendment business, engaged in a direct assault on free speech and the very foundation of our democracy, because our very individual freedoms have now become fair game for the secrecy regime, all in the name and under the mantle and cloak called national security. In fact, I can make an argument that government increasingly prefers to operate in the shadows and finds the First Amendment a constraint on its activities. And yet taking off the veil of government secrecy has more often than not turned truth tellers and whistleblowers into turncoats and traitors, who are then often criminally burned, blacklisted, and broken by the government on the stake of national security. Egregious violations of the Fourth Amendment, many still occurring in secret far beyond the awareness and knowledge of most Americans, are eroding and chipping away the First Amendment. For example, the Patriot Act, along with a number of other enabling acts, including the recently reauthorized FISA Amendments Act, plus many more, including massive abuse of CALEA, ECPA, and CFAA, are now blunt-end instruments of a Homeland Security and surveillance apparatus that legalizes government deception, citizen monitoring, and wrongdoing, while those who reveal government wrongdoing, illegality, and embarrassment are often prosecuted and increasingly indicted for speaking truth to power. I know. I knew too much truth and exposed government illegalities, fraud, and abuse, and was turned into a criminal for doing so. I was charged under the Espionage Act, faced many years in prison, and became an enemy of the state. It was 5 years of living under the boot of the surveillance state. And yet, I was saved by the First Amendment and the court of public opinion and the free press, including the strength and growing resiliency of the alternative media, the very cornerstone of all of our liberties and freedoms, the one on which all the rest rely, the active voice and conscience of the Constitution of the United States of America. Freedom means everything to me, and especially when I face the prospect of having all my freedoms taken away from me and placed under all kinds of restrictions in movement and monitored activity for several years. So for the sake of our common future and the country we want to keep, we must ask of ourselves some very hard questions. Is the First Amendment becoming a casualty in an indefinite, undeclared war where notions of a free press, public interest, and informed citizenry get in the way of national security interests defined in secret? In our wired and wireless world, what happens to anonymous speech and the press on the internet when the government has a persistent dragnet surveillance system in place, the emergence of a virtual Orwellian state? Do we really want the government listening in on and tracking the lives of so many others? Have our constitutional freedoms become the latest victims of 9/11? Is the intolerance shown by the secret federal government for the magnificent of our precious First Amendment freedoms a foreboding of things to come? Will national security replace our individual rights? Will fear take priority over freedom? Will government censorship and propaganda triumph over personal choice and disclosure? Is suppression and repression the instrument for stamping out dissent? Will government embarrassment extinguish exposure? Is the tree of liberty becoming an endangered species? And if we starve liberty for the increasingly myopic sake of security, what will we have left to defend? What happens when the acid of secrecy and suppression erode the very bedrock of the First Amendment? What happens when the sources of what is really happening in government increasingly choose not to speak to the press? What happens when we increasingly self-censor ourselves and the news is not fit to print because it invites undue government attention? How else will the press report the real news when their sources dry up and the government becomes a primary purveyor of its own news? It is our freedom of choice that is at stake as citizens, and not the governments to just take away from us in secret under the guise of keeping us safe from ourselves. We must now rescue the Constitution from our very own government before it becomes a hollow shell of its former self. The rights we have, the rights, not privileges, the rights we have under the First Amendment are the living blueprint and beacon for our personal freedoms and power of choice. George Orwell said, quote, "If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear," unquote. When there is no transparency, openness, or public accountability for the deeds of government, including secret surveillance, torture, kill lists, the cover the AUMF used to justify our foreign policy, abandonment of due process, FOIA redactions and delays, prosecutorial overreach and misconduct only invites further abuse, secret rule, and unchecked power by the government. What happens to our country what happens to our country when laws are secretly reinterpreted behind closed doors by government officials who prefer to operate in the shadows without public debate, but promote and support laws that violate the privacy and protections afforded by the Constitution for the sake of national security. So are we willing to forsake our liberties for the sake of security, when in fact it is our very liberties which define the heart and core of our national security? What is more pernicious in terms of a freedom of the press and an informed citizenry when the very sources are threatened with life in prison for simply telling the truth about the government? You see, the First Amendment, of all the amendments, is an invaluable protection for public freedom against government overreach and intrusion into our lives, our fortunes, and our very futures. Do we want to let the First Amendment join the list of endangered species, where the remaining descendants end up in a zoo somewhere behind a cage for people to come and gawk? As Kevin Gostola, a remarkable investigative reporter with Fire Dog Lake, said just yesterday in his article, quote, "What is worse, a powerful person telling citizens they have no right to know because they fervently believe that all hell will break loose if they allow any transparency, or a powerful person who purports to favor transparency and openness telling citizens they do not have a right to know because he or she is not that powerful person who has contempt for open government," unquote. In an open and transparent society, the citizenry are supposed to know the truth of its own government. So if the First Amendment is the sunshine of our liberty, how else are we to remain free if the government casts its shadows over you and me?
Thank you.
I think we've got time for one more story. North Carolina prepares to suppress black voters now that the Voting Rights Act has lost its teeth. Just days after the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, North Carolina is moving forward with a host of bills to roll back voting rights. Republican lawmakers are accelerating the new agenda to eliminate early voting, Sunday voting hours, the same-day registration provisions. GOP leaders also vowed to move quickly to pass a controversial voting ID law that would make it harder for minorities, seniors, students, and low-income voters to cast their ballots. The court's conservative majority decreed last Tuesday that the formula used to identify states with a history of using election law to discriminate has no logical relationship to the present day. Many of the covered jurisdictions celebrated the decision by promptly advancing voters' restrictions that disproportionately target minorities and low-income voters. Texas enacted their previously blocked voter ID law mere hours after the ruling. North Carolina has a newly unfettered attack on voting rights has three main prongs: require ID at the poll. North Carolina voter ID law could pose problems for 1 in 10 voters, according to analysis by the State Board of Elections. About 613,000 North Carolinians lack the required government issue ID. Nearly a third of these voters are black, while over half are registered Democrats. Penalize college students for voting. Republicans are pushing a bill to raise taxes on families with college students who choose to vote at school rather than at home, effectively discouraging students from voting. And end early voting and same-day registration. Other states have restricted early voting, like Ohio and Florida, needlessly creating mammoth lines on election day, forcing voters to wait until 1 a.m. sometimes to cast votes. Backlash in Florida has been particularly strong, prompting Rick Scott to reverse his own voters' suppression law. In North Carolina, black voters make up 29% of the voters, early voters, and 34% of voters took advantage of the same-day voter registration. Republican-dominated legislature and new Republican government were likely to do all they can to speed along these restrictions. However, polls show that North Carolinians overwhelmingly oppose these new voter suppression measures. Moral Monday protests are cropping up all over the state to challenge these bills and slew of other draconian policies targeting the poor, women, minorities, and seniors. That's it for today. Progressive News Network, I want to thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk to you on Sunday the 7th. Hope you tune in. Thanks a lot. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. And remember, there is a better world a-coming, and we'll be talking to you soon.
They said the students scared the guard, though the troops were battle-dressed. Before mothers and their new degrees, the bachelor's. I know we're all fed up with useless wars and racial strife. The next time they will ride, well, you best stay out of sight. When there's a ride going on, when there's a ride going on.
Bye-bye.